After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
And maybe let's get into specifically these union-related connections, mm-hmm. right? So maybe let's start with one James Hoffa. James Riddle Hoffa. And then we can get into Walter Roythe
yeah,
later.
Yeah, Hoffa is so interesting because, like, okay, he... In a nutshell, is basically what happens if organized crime is allowed to take over an entire union. And there are other examples, but this is probably the most visible, most disastrous version.
So I'm just going to interject yeah. quickly, too. And the reason why the unions are susceptible to this kind of activity, I would almost argue that like Hoffa and Roythe are kind of like opposite coins of the same phenomenon, but... As we'll get into with like the student movement and radical politics, this particular era of history is formative to understanding what will become the left coalition in the United States. Because during the war, the Second World War, and then primarily after, you go from there actually being like a committed, visibly communist contingent on the left to having it basically being suppressed and shut down. So the forms that come in to replace it in its various avenues are ones that are not necessarily more or less right-wing, but ones that do not take that perspective or that framework.
Mm-hmm.
And Hoffa comes in and almost like, I'm not going to say he's non-ideological, but he's
anti-communist, as you stated, though, for sure.
For sure, for sure. He's definitely anti-business, but he, at the same time, he's like, you know, he correctly says, what do I stand to get from this? And that is his guiding principle in some of his actions.
So, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to ask is like, well, before we get into that, how accurate do you think Martin Scorsese's The Irishman was?
In terms of the specifics, I would argue that it's probably not literally true as to like which guys mm-hmm. were doing what, but like in a broad sense, some pretty accurate, I think. Like Hoffa was okay. probably later in his life. He was probably crookeder sooner even maybe than the film, and he got even more off the rails than maybe the film shows. But in broad strokes, I liked The Irishman and I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting though, Adi, is that I have episodes on this coming out soon, actually. Jimmy Hoffa was trained by a guy named Farrell Dobbs. He was taught how to do, you know, union negotiating. He was taught how to like bust balls and how to run meetings and shit. By this guy, Farrell Dobbs. Farrell Dobbs learned that shit from Leon Trotsky.
Oh, man. And
there is literally just, what is that? So one, two, three. Is that like 1 degree of separation?
This is the new Twitter challenge. How many handshakes are you away from shaking hands with Leon Trotsky?
Yeah, and there are literally things that Hoffa would do in meetings that Leon Trotsky would do. I'm talking like leadership tics, not like ideological stuff.
So like the one scene where he's cussing out everybody in the
yeah,
room?
No, literally that kind of shit. And like in placing a high importance on like punctuality and even locking the door so that anyone coming in late has to like embarrass themselves. Like Hoffa did that shit and Trotsky did that shit. Freaking nuts. Not to like say Hoffa's bad because Trotsky, but like it is interesting though, right?
There is a lot of emphasis placed on mind games to play on people, right? Like even LBJ, I know he's not part of the same project, but even he had his own brand of the Johnson treatment, right?
Yeah, no, and like Hoffa literally challenged RFK to like a push-up match, and like that's like the dumb guy version of shit Trotsky would do, basically. Which, can I just say, like, how freaking, like, say what you will, sometimes Hoffa was pretty based. I think that's still, like, kind of cool.
Which again is like, I think like, that's why I think he's correct to be like, well, what's in it for me? Mm-hmm. Because if you're not approaching this from a kind of like a labor organizing tradition or an ideological perspective, then you have one of the, and I would argue this is a correct motive for being part of a union, which is self-interest. It's one of the ethical ways to be self-interested for sure. But in Hoffa's case, he's like, yeah, no, there's money to be made here.
Yeah, no, he was definitely like the evil type of union member. But I mean, yeah, based in like a logical self-interest mode. What should...
Calling him Booby Kennedy? That was...
what should I say about Hoffa? I mean, I could talk like forever about him, but I'm not sure what, how much to do.
I mean, so the broad strokes of Hoffa are pretty well known, right? Is that like, you know, the Teamsters Union, if not being without having either it's having its balls broken collectively by the mob, or is infiltrated by elements of organized crime, if not being used to facilitate elements of organized crime. It's trucking. You know what I mean? It's going to come up in that line of work, I guess.
Yeah, like it started as being linked to the syndicates. We're talking Italian mm-hmm. and Jewish organized crime. But
yep. which in Michigan are the big ones. Yeah,
that's right. But at a certain point, literally, the feds worked with organized crime to clear the communists out of the Teamster Union. Like, Jimmy Hoffa basically was offered an evil Sith deal to basically cut Farrell Dobbs' throat, so to speak, and to basically, like, literally beat up all the fucking communists that were in the Teamsters. And, you know, they did that. It was basically Hoffa and his goons, and the feds were assisting. And basically, they turned the Teamsters into what was at that point, and probably still maybe, like the most right-wing union in the United States.
Yeah, and I think this is another thing that comes up sometimes where like people will be like, well, isn't there a way to like shift organized crime to the left? And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that. It doesn't. They're already working against you in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess to that end, the thing about Hoffa that everyone always disputes is...
who killed him?
Who exactly killed him? Where is the body? There's multiple competing claims. So, again, to bring up the Irishman, not that... I don't really believe the premise of it. The only thing I really believe from that movie is that, yeah, this guy definitely moved guns for the Bay of Pigs. I definitely believe that.
I think there might actually be like actual paper, like memoranda talking about it. I think that might actually be like provable.
Right, right. But basically, like in that novel, Frank Sheeran basically alleges that he was the one who shot Hoffa and like helped dispose of the body via cremation. There's been multiple people who claim to know where the body is. There's multiple people who claim to be involved with moving it. And somehow all these sites and searches turn out to be inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
The main operating theory is that it's the Italian mob in Detroit, specifically going by the name of the Detroit Partnership.
Mm-hmm.
That's a smart name to use. You don't use the mob.
Sounds nice. Like La
Cosa. You don't use the term. Exactly. You don't use the crime family. You call it the partnership.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So basically, yeah, Tony Jack, one of the members, is alleged to be one of the people Hoffa was last seen with. People recall witnessing him going into a car, and then that was the last anyone had seen of him. I think he recalled, there's like a phone record saying he called his wife before that. And then no one knows what happened after that.
Like, the mob likes to have people close to you do it. So, like, I buy that, like, the guys that were around him in Detroit could have been the ones who actually pulled the trigger. But, like, he interacted with, like, all of the top guys, like, in the country, you know? Like, he was, like,
yeah,
talking to like frickin' Santo Traficante Jr. and shit. Like, so like, I don't know which of those guys, it was probably a collective decision, decided to off him. But like, I do think the mafia did it, and who knows where the body is.
Personally, I think he was just breaking balls. I think they overreacted. That's just
should have kept his mouth shut.
Hey, take it easy.
You do a better accent than me.
But accents are my weird gift. I try not to abuse it. But yeah, I think like the mob is a reasonable contender. I still think like there has to be something said for like business interest at least signing off on it or being like pleasantly surprised by it after the fact. I'm not sure. I wish I did a little more reading on like how people reacted to the fallout of the event, right? Because Hoffa might have been a controversial figure to say the least, even in his time, but it had to have been seen as like this blow to the confidence and self-assuredness of the trade union movement at the time, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking up my Hoffa thread. I'm trying to see if there's anything I should mention first. Let's see here. I mean, the Irishman talks about the Teamster Pension Fund, but that was basically a slush fund for organized crime. It's just remarkable. And I know that there were spies in the mix. So, you know, not just the FBI, actually. There were, like, deeper intelligence ties monitoring and interacting with Hoffa. I don't think that they killed him. It probably would have still been the mafia, but let's see here. That's probably too much to get into. Let's see here. Because I have this whole private theory that the Kennedys were warring with Hoffa because they represented different factions of organized crime.
That's, again, it's a reasonable operating theory, right? But it's like the evidence, so to speak, would be so out of hand that you can't do anything other than maybe like spin some kind of maybe well-reasoned conjecture of it. But I mean, he definitely, you know, he earned his beef with them. You know, it's not like he had no reason to hate them. So you know what I mean?
It's like, well, they did kill Kennedy, but on the flip side, Hoffa died. So who ended up winning? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure what to read of the broader implications of like the JFK assassination and the Hoffa assassination. We'll probably also have to tie this into the Reuther assassination, right?
Yeah.
But these are like weird like blows to morale for like this kind of nascent left formation in the United States. I'm not going to say that like these are part of like a real like Marxist tradition. They're not at all. I would argue they're more liberal in their conception, period. But like, I can't help but feel like in the case of like JFK and Hoffa, it's like to, this is the specific ones you do to like certain ideologically motivated factions among white people to be like, yep, no, we can either kill you in broad daylight or make you disappear. And then in the case of, you know, MLK, the Panthers, Malcolm X, it's specifically pointing to the black community to be like, hey, we could do it to you too, and we'll do it to your most prolific leaders.
Yeah, we'll kill MLK and then we'll shoot his like widow. Like, what the fuck? Or was it his widow or was it his mom? I don't remember, but either way.
I don't recall. It was, And again, like, I found out about the MLK shooting basically being one of those things that, like, the government themselves admitted to being involved in.
Yeah.
Until, like, very late in my life. And I'm like, oh.
Like,
very cool that you guys can investigate yourselves and still admit, like, oh, we investigated ourselves and we found no wrongdoing.
Interesting. No, it's crazy. Like, I have people in my life who, like, will not budge on the JFK assassination being, you know, done by the government. But, like, the same people absolutely are like, yeah, I could see the MLK one. You know, like, that is, like, an easier sell for people, I think.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, relating to Hoffa, I think I said this in a thread, you know, years ago, but, like, the working class is stuck in a double bind because they are fucked if they don't have a union. But then to get a union, you often have to play dirty. And to keep a union, you often have to play dirty. And, like,
right.
Then if you try to stick to your principles and don't get dirty, oftentimes you lose. But if you fight back, then you end up losing. Like, Hoffa is an example of, like, he played dirty, but he played to win, and then he got killed anyway. Like, Reuther is, like you said, a good side to the other coin because he fought enough, but he didn't get as dirty as Hoffa, and they fucking killed him too. Different people, granted,
and Roy, but still. And Reuther, to me, is very interesting, right? Because he represents, like, this kind of ideological and ethical art to JFK era liberalism and great society liberalism that Hoffa does not provide, JFK himself does not provide, and Reuther is kind of this, like, self-contained, almost like the read I have of him is, like, he's kind of like the heart and soul of liberalism in this era, basically, in terms of leadership.
Yeah, he kind of was, like, he has thought or acted like Kennedy was. Yeah.
Pretty much. Like, he had the right position on civil rights. He had the right position on, I mean, even, like, he was pretty early kind of correct on environmental conservation, on, you know, he was definitely an anti-communist, though.
Yeah.
I mean, he was also responsible on his end for maybe not necessarily as harsh communist purges as Hoffa, but definitely involved in purging communists from the UAW.
He would use them and then marginalize them, but he wouldn't usually beat them up. That was the difference between him and Hoffa.
Yeah, Reuther, to me, kind of, like, represents this kind of, like, no, we can very much hold this power within the Democratic coalition for ourselves. And as long as, like, we stay righteous somehow, like, we get to keep it. And I think, like, Reuther, you know, for all that he tried to do, was just proven wrong by force, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So with his assassination specifically, what is it that, like, he's in a helicopter and it crashes under mysterious circumstances?
Actually, it's my bad. So I think, let's see here. So
And this isn't the first. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, so they were basically brothers, right? So there was Victor and Walter. And Victor was basically, well, both of them went through multiple assassination attempts, but Walter is the one that they basically took out by airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically his airplane crashed, and there are a lot of anomalies about it. And Michael Parenti, if any of your listeners like him, very much links his death to JFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and RFK.
Yeah, let me pull up the specific quote because I think it was on Wikipedia. Sorry. So specifically,
he literally survived a other plane crash. Like, the year before. Like, they were trying to murder him, and they probably did.
Yeah. So, journalist Michael Parenti wrote, quote, Reuther's demise appears as part of a truncation of liberal and radical leadership that included the deaths of four national figures, President John Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Senator Robert Kennedy. I don't think all of them like held necessarily like the same amounts of clout or like the same, not even the same views. I mean, Malcolm X is not part of the same project.
Yeah.
MLK gets deemed as the more liberal one, but is kind of like
he was developing and yeah.
Yeah, he was almost like trade union socialism towards the end of his life, but we never got to see how that played out, unfortunately.
Yeah, not all of them had equal amounts of power. Yeah.
Exactly. We also got Robert Vesco mentioned here. Do we want to bring him up?
No, that's... okay, for the listeners, I'll say Robert Vesco was one of many con men that seemed to either start or end their time in Michigan. The TLDR on Robert Vesco is basically he did a really interesting thing because he was doing... Basically, he was a con man, but like a corporate one. So he would basically like buy one company on credit and then use the money from the company he just acquired to pay back the loans for what, you know, acquiring the company in the first place. And then he would leverage that to buy another company. And then basically he would just like leapfrog from company to company acquiring them and typically like raiding the funds and like often leaving zombie companies and just creating a mess, basically. He was doing it on behalf of organized crime. He ends up taking over a very shady, weird finance intelligence like Ponzi scheme called, I think, Investors Overseas something, IOS. And that was basically a money laundering operation internationally. And he like leapfrogs his way all the way into like basically stealing like a $1 billion hedge fund. And then he basically then ends up towards the end of his life in like Panama, where he's like a fucking like warlord. And like, he's just some guy from fucking Detroit. Like, he's just a con man. And he ends up like very possibly almost taking over multiple different islands in the Caribbean, like, and heavily, heavily involved in like the drug trade. Like, Robert Vesco's such a weird dude, and he's from Michigan. He was abetted at every stage by like basically the mob.
Maybe let's quickly go over is like, here we got the pizza connection and the purple gang. These connections are touchy too. Detroit is also this understated location and section in the chapters of organized crime, right? Because it's got, Detroit is kind of like derided, especially in like more right wing, basically racist circles, as like this lawless city hellscape ruined by black people. But prior to that, you know, crime has been part of every city's history. It's not a new phenomenon. It's very, you know, selective outrage on their part to do that. But I think specifically like the Italian mob, one with its ties to the Hoffa case, had a presence with the Detroit partnership. And then the Purple Gang is an interesting one too. They show up around the 20s. This is a Jewish mob that's running out of Detroit and I think is involved in both bootlegging and liquor smuggling, especially across the border to Canada or from Canada.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of like also, garment stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Garment stuff specifically. I think like there was literally a crime wave involving garments called the Cleaner and Dyer's War.
Yeah.
That they were a part of. Carr gets into it in his book, but basically it's like the cleaning and dyeing industry in Detroit was so like poorly managed. There was no uniform price structure. So unions try to step in to like, you know, both negotiate better working conditions as well as like regulate a price structure. But the Purple Gang basically comes in, infiltrates the union and like starts, you know, exerting its influence because they see the money that can be made off of this, especially with union dues, punishing people for not paying dues, and then turning it into protection rackets almost.
Yeah, and then like they use their muscle in a general sense too, with like garment factories to basically like artificially suppress wages very low. And that's how you end up making money, because like you're making clothes for like way less money than the margins ought to be. And that continues today. Like that like garment hustle is ongoing.
Yeah, now it's in Vietnam and Bangladesh instead of here, but the hustle is fundamentally the same. Instead of the mob doing it, it's textiles companies.
So like there were like also like newspaper wars over like syndication or over like distribution routes and stuff. And then like obviously Prohibition was the big one. So a lot of these gangs basically ballooned in size because of like bootlegging. And then when Prohibition ended, a lot of these, you know, groups, some went legit through liquor companies, but others like looked around for things to do. And hey, wouldn't you know, there's drugs, you know, there's, you know, obviously the classic like rackets of gambling and prostitution and pornography, you know, they went into that as well. But the TLDR is that like the Jewish syndicate, it worked pretty much like the Italian one, like the Irish ones. There used to be German organized crime, which is funny to think about. And, you know, eventually they got in really tight with Hoffa, and they end up, you know, accumulating enough wealth that they, you know, basically for a long time they were running Cuba. That didn't work around 1957, 1958. Internationally speaking, like they end up moving to the Dominican Republic, but also increasingly Vegas, and also increasingly like the Bahamas, like Nassau and so forth. Things like, you know, Resorts International. Next thing you know, we got Trump.
Oh boy.
So you see these things just perpetuate, right? But like, it's just, it's so interesting how basically in like one generation, one or two generations, like these same Italian and Jewish gangsters end up going from like small time garment hustles and like racketeering and like, you know, just bootlegging to next thing you know, like you're running Las Vegas. Next thing you know, like you're like trying to kill Fidel Castro. Like these things really escalate, as they say.
Yeah. And I think the Purple Gang, specifically this Jewish syndicate, earned their name because, like, their crimes were so vicious for whatever reason that they earned the name Purple in an interview because somebody compared them to, like, the foulness of rotting meat, hence Purple. Mm. So that's the origin of the term.
Which is funny because, like, later on they kind of eschewed violence, you know, more or less you trying to, like, stay out of the spotlight because, you know, they like to have the Italian mob like get a lot of the bad press for being too violent after a certain point.
Well, what are you going to do? It's bad for business.
Exactly.
But this is just a little bit of trivia because that's the extent of my knowledge on the Purple Gang. You can still visit one of the spots where this gang used to hang out. It's called the Schwitz in Detroit. It's like was usually the I think it used to be called the Russian and Turkish baths or something like that. So those old-timey mom bathhouses, there's one that's still up and running. Granted, it's more of a novelty experience now. It's still pretty cool, but it's still like, yeah, it's an old Purple Gang hangout. They didn't run the place, but they hung out there.
Interesting.
And I imagine there had to have been some kind of white Russian circles running in with the Purple Gang as well, but I cannot speak to that conclusively.
Well, I know for sure that white Russians were heavily involved with Henry Ford.
Well, there it goes. There it is.
Who brought the protocols of the Elders of Zion over? It was the white Russians that Henry Ford was hanging out with for no reason in particular, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, I think we've talked about the underground elite, so to speak. Maybe let's talk about the ones who live on the surface, so to speak. Michigan is also the site of several quote unquote legitimate institutions and enterprises that hold a lot of financial and reputational power, as well as a couple influential families, so to speak. So one thing I'm going to just throw out there, right, is people mention Trump's resurgence or his emergence in 2016 as this like kind of fringe event. One thing that I had the, you know, I was able to notice by virtue of living in Michigan at the time, right, is like his first big rally after he comes down the escalator from Trump Tower is in Birch Run, Michigan. And something that is also worth mentioning at this point, right, is that Michigan's Republican Party itself, although I'm not sure to what extent this is true today, had a reputation as being one of the most well-funded and I'd say like very well-run state Republican parties in the union, so to speak. And you tie that in with the broader nexus of the American right, not to say that, oh yeah, no, the Republican coalition includes the militias. It also includes white nationalists. You know, it's dicey saying all that, right? I can simply say though that like the lull in like militia activity all of a sudden coming back after Trump makes it into the mainstream is something to note. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, it is interesting. I think sometimes, not to hate on liberals too much, they sometimes don't understand, you know, what is the tail and what is the dog and what's making what do what, you know?
Right.
Like,
I think sometimes they don't even notice the dog itself sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, these things are like leading up right up into heavy industry of Michigan and then like funding these things downstream and then like even further down, like there's like, yeah, like the militia stuff, like you said.
Yeah, so let's maybe get into some of the elite families of Michigan, right? So Blackwater and its former, I think, CEO Eric Prince, right? He builds a reputation for himself, I think, in the wake of the Iraq War as this guy who turns basically like what's a gun range with a survival camp into a private mercenary company. And what's interesting to note about him is that he's heavily tied to the DeVos family. So if people were pissed about Betsy DeVos, who was the education secretary during the Trump administration, she's basically, you know, one of the members of this highly wealthy and influential family, stood to make a lot of money from the privatization of schools and the implementation of charter schools, which was their fundamental goal. And ironically, I think the DeVos fortune came from a company called Amway, if you're familiar with
them. Oh, yeah. Adi, so I'm Mormon. I know all about the MLMs.
So literally, Michigan has a hand in the invention of the pyramid scheme once again. Oh, God. And I think her husband, Dick, ran like a failed attempt for governor in 04 or something, I think. But they remain heavily influential and wealthy in Republican politics and just that sector of the elite to this day. Another one that, again, it's very suspect of me to bring on the Mormon dude to ask about this. But we can't talk about Michigan elite families without talking about the Romneys.
Let's do it.
So let's start with the worst question first. Are they the Royal Mormon Family of America?
I think it's a lot more of like a oligarchy aristocracy type of situation. So like, there's no one family, right? It's probably more like maybe 100 or more that are like the Mormon royalty, but for sure it's like one of the top 10, probably, if not top 5 in terms of like, yeah, for sure.
They are very early converts by ancestry to Mormonism. And specifically, I think with, I forget at what point the family goes to Mexico, right?
That's right. The family goes to Mexico. I think it would have been around like the 1880s ballpark. Because like basically the TLDR for your listeners is that the Mormon church practiced polygamy out in Utah. And at a certain point, the nanny state came over and said, you can't practice polygamy. I'm joking. So they outlawed it. And there was a point at which the federal government confiscated large swaths of like the church's property and just imprisoned like the top leadership. Crazy stuff, actually. Mm-hmm. And so basically at a certain point, the church said, okay, we're not practicing polygamy in the United States. And a certain number of the Mormons basically went to Mexico, set up colonies, kind of like there are also just like Amish and like Mennonite communities in Mexico.
Irish communities too. Like there's a lot of, Mexico's a little more forgiving with its immigration into it than the United States was for whatever reason.
Yeah. And so basically there were these Mormon colonies. And at a certain point, the Mormon church was like, okay, no polygamy anywhere. And at certain junctures, certain families were like, okay, no more polygamy. And other families broke off and were like, we're doing our own thing here, whether in Mexico or in the U.S. And so that's sort of like where you see factions like the FLDS or other unaffiliated polygamous groups. And so the Romneys always stayed with the mainline church and stopped doing polygamy after, you know, the people died who were already married polygamously. Gotcha. And, you know, the TLDR is that they were fucking weirdo polygamists in Mexico. Like, it's weird. Like, I wanted to say, I met Mitt Romney. He didn't meet me. I shook his hand at a rally once when I was a good little Mormon many years ago.
Gotcha. What was that like? Well, is that what you mean by limp handshake? Is that what you mean?
Yes, actually. He had a weak handshake.
Oh, man.
But, I mean, I guess if you're meeting a bunch of people, you can't squeeze. I'm not going to defend Mitt Romney. I don't like the man, so. Just throwing it out.
I'm assuming if you were younger. I'm guessing if you were younger, he was like, okay, I'm not going to shake the hell out of this kid's hand, but.
Yeah, I bet when you're a politician, you have to shake a million hands. You probably make it a little weak. The old Hank Hill joke from King of the Hill, right?
Yeah, instead of doing that weird Trump, like, pull your arm off thing. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think with the Romney family, a lot of people, like, attribute their weirdness to being Mormon when I think, like, me as a non-white observer, I'm like, I just chalk this up to them being white and rich, really.
Yeah, they're freakish not just because they're Mormon. It's also because they're, like, billionaires. But, like, insane. Like, they have so much more in common with other people of their class than, like, with me. Obviously, there's some similarities and, you know, whatever. I'm not trying to defend the Romneys because I really do not like them, but.
Yeah, so specifically where the Romneys tie into Michigan, right, is that at some point, the first member of the family to make it back to the United States, I think, from Mexico is George Romney. Is an auto executive for not General Motors or Ford. I think it's for like
American Motors Corporation.
Yeah, which I forget which one American Motors gets folded into. Let me see.
I think ultimately Chrysler acquired them.
That makes sense. And Chrysler is the big acquisitions hound these days. It's not even Chrysler anymore. It's this weird thing called... what are they going by these days? Fucking. They got bought out by Peugeot from France, and now they're going by some weird name.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on. Chrysler. Stellantis. That's what they're going by now.
Mm.
So Stellantis is this monster corporation that's just made up of the dead husks of every other automotive company that isn't Ford or GM.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, George works for the American Motors Company, gains prominence within the Michigan Republican Party. And was tied to Victor Reuther, leads the Detroit Victory Council, right? Mm. So Romney posits himself, and I don't, you know, I'm not going to accuse him of not being genuine in this case. This is merely more so like a time in American history where like such a thing as a liberal Republican could exist.
Yeah. And in fact was more one so of the than, more dominant factions in the Republican Party.
Yeah, yeah. And George Romney makes this like name for himself as like this liberal Republican, as this champion for liberal causes and this ally of what we would deem as objectively good things, right? But he presides as the governor of Michigan during the Detroit riots. And I had an initial project to like try to examine his role as governor in how these events played out and whether or not you could personally deem him culpable for how things went down. Turns out the project has grown wildly in scope. I got started with one book and now we're at like, what, 20 or something?
Hell's
so it. Let's see. This might have to be a whole series I take on at some point. But basically, like, what I see with Romney as like, he's kind of like, yeah, the dying breed of liberal Republican as this party is taking the Nixonite turn. It's taking the Southern strategy seriously. He's basically beaten out of the party as like an influential figure because the riot happens in the first place, and it basically triggers this wave of white reaction and white flight, one in Metro Detroit that has like shaped the modern landscape to this day,
mm-hmm.
but probably sets the tone for race relations at that point onwards, right?
Yeah, I think that was a real watershed for race relations for sure.
And then to top it off as well, right, is that Romney makes it to head of housing and urban development, and has this plan to, yes, enable suburbanization, but his initial plan is to integrate the suburbs or to prevent redlining and segregation from happening. And that doesn't go according to plan. And we get suburbanization, but we get this increased amount of segregation that actually gets implemented, which again, the fascism of the automobile plays out once again.
Yeah.
In the development of the suburbs. And I would argue that the formation of the suburbs is like this watershed moment in the formation of American conservatism as we understand it today.
Yes.
But that's a topic I'm still working through. It's a lot to get through.
Now, at the expense of sounding like some sort of Mormon defender here, it is interesting because Romney, Governor Romney, is a weird echo of Joseph Smith in that mm-hmm. Joseph Smith had this, it sounds harebrained, but if it would have worked, it would have been probably less bad than the Civil War. He had this plan to like buy every slave and basically free them. and to like pay for it with taxes or some wonky like way of like avoiding the Civil War.
Taxpayer funded manumission, basically. Yeah.
And like he was made fun of at the time for it, but it would have been probably better than like 500,000 people dead from the Civil War. And like Romney's plan to maybe try to avoid redlining and all these other things didn't fucking work. And it's like, if you were someone who were invested in this system, you would think that you would want to carry that out to maintain the stability of the system. But like, nobody's in charge of these levers. That's the thing. You know, we're talking conspiracy theory, but no one's in charge of all the levers. It's just a bunch of people advancing their own self-interest through conspiracies. And no one's like in charge of everything. So like, things are just bad all the time. And the reason why it's always bad decision after bad decision after bad decision is because of all of these fucking conspiracies.
And this is also why, like, we'll have to revisit this topic in, you know, some of the later topics we're going to discuss of what if we get inside the system to change it from within. Is, I won't say it's an inherently bad idea, nor do I think that people who believe that have their heart in the wrong place. But time in, time out, we start to realize, like, it's not nearly as simple as it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you being the only good person at the table puts you in further jeopardy than not being at the table.
Often almost puts you in personal jeopardy. Yeah, because it's like, either you'll just get sidelined like Governor Romney here, or they'll make your fucking plane crash like Reuther, or they'll stuff you in a barrel like Jimmy Hoffa, or, you know, you'll just be sidelined altogether like all kinds of other people.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, I'm not saying this to malign, I still got to read on this history, mm-hmm. so I can't like be the person who deems him guilty on this, right? But
probably is, though.
At the end of the day, is that, you know, being a liberal Republican, the Republican's not the operative word, it's liberal in this case. And I'm pretty sure that, like, he was defeated and then he took his hat in his hand and went home, as a good liberal does, even though, like, if you're girded in your convictions, you should stand and fight harder. But I don't know. I really don't know enough to say that.
Yeah.
What I am going to ask, though, is Mitt a fail son from George in this case? Or what do you think?
Well, I don't know. Fail son, I think, does imply a certain lack of ability to even function in the fake PMC world that exists. And Mitt did nothing if not succeed in terms of, like, corporate bullshit.
That's so true.
I think, honestly, I actually have more sympathy for George Romney than Mitt Romney. I think Mitt Romney might go to hell. I don't know if that's true for George Romney. Probably also, but I'm throwing it out there. Mitt Romney, probably a worse person than his dad.
Yeah, I'd say, like, George Romney is definitely the more sympathetic of the two in this case. And I think, like, again, maybe he's just a product of his time where, like, such a thing as a liberal Republican could exist in a time where Mitt's entry into politics simply does not. But yeah.
Mitt Romney had to meet with Trump. He had to, like, kiss his ass. Like, George Romney just went home, like, you know. I guess he did.
Yeah,
he did kind of like fall. He did kind of like also like back Nixon. So what am I talking about? They both did the same thing.
I guess what's worse, kissing Nixon's ass or kissing Trump's ass? And I'm not saying that as,
it's a genuine question. I don't know what's worse.
And we're not even close to those positions of power to even make that judgment call. Not to sympathize, but mm-hmm. just like, you know, it's, I would, My operating thesis as of late has been, like, the 70s and the present, if not identical, are echoes of each other in some capacity. And I think for us in 2023, we've inherited the crumbling remains of the 70s, so to speak.
Yes. We don't even pretend like we have a great society.
No, yeah, we don't even do. It's no longer a great society. It is, we live in a society.
Maybe.
Sorry.
Maybe the aughts were pretending like there was a great society, and then like the 2020s are just like the 70s. Like, there's no fucking great society.
Yeah, and it's like, as we'll get into with like some of this stuff with radical politics, we're going to see echoes of that past in our present as we discuss that. Mm-hmm. But we got one other thing in our topic list of elite families. I got Gerald Ford as a useful idiot on the subject of Nixon. Now, Ford is only tangentially tied to Michigan. I think like his connection is that after his mother divorces his biological father, I think she marries a man from Michigan. I don't know if they move to Michigan afterwards, but I know he attends the University of Michigan after, so that's his tangential connection to it.
Mm. Well, I mean, Gerald Ford was a useful idiot for sure.
If not directly from Michigan, how so?
Well, let me think here, because I didn't think out too much the Gerald Ford stuff, but basically, I mean, I don't think they were ever planning on Ford being president. It was sort of a quirk of history. I don't think people really saw Nixon going down. And so consequently, you know, there are certain VPs where you really don't think they'll ever be president. And then occasionally they do. He's definitely an example. I wish I could remember more of the, I don't know if you've ever heard of this author, Rick Perlstein. I know that Chrisman talks about him a lot, being one of the few books he's read. Just kidding. But he talks a lot. I mean, Perlstein talks a lot about Ford, and I wish I could freaking remember half of it.
Yeah, I guess like Ford just basically exists to press all the buttons. Like, this is what I'm reduced to in understanding this part of history. It's like you have to skip all the dialogue to get to the tutorial in the game. That's what he's doing when he's signing all the pardons. He's just like skipping to the fucking tutorial.
Gerald Ford was the stopgap so that the Republican Jimmy Carter could come in and fuck over the unions and basically privatize huge swaths of the economy so that there could be a even more Republican, you know, Ronald Reagan to come in after that.
Yeah, and I think that's a downstated or understated reality of both Carter and Nixon, is that Reagan, people correctly associate with neoliberalism in American history. People tend to forget Carter's own role in, if not in like setting it up, definitely like creating the conditions for it and intentionally trying to trigger a recession almost. And the Volcker shock and all that shit was him, you know?
No, yeah. He was not planning on winning another, like, he wasn't even trying. Like, they picked, like, okay, I'm going to sound conspiratorial here. The Trilateral Commission picked Jimmy Carter to do this shit, to basically, like, cut the Achilles heel of just the Democratic Party so that Reagan could happen. I'm sorry. That is exactly what happened. Jimmy Carter was a maniac. Gerald Ford was like an accident of history that just allowed Jimmy Carter and then Reagan to happen.
This was part 3 of our Sus Michigan episode featuring Jimmy Fallon Gong. Jimmy runs a great podcast called Program to Chill that I encourage you to check out. I'll have links to the show in the description below, as well as our links to our own social media as well. Thanks again for tuning in, dear listener. Take care.